8, 8 minutes after 9 o'clock. Welcome into Friday. It's the 9th day of January, and we're brought to you by Landscaper's Corner. 1305 Old Frankfort Pike, Landscaper's Corner, has the largest selection of natural stone in our area. Call them at 225-9433. Our question of the day, brought to you by United Structural Systems, your foundation repair and waterproofing experts, ifixfoundations.com, 859-254-7700. After the attack at French Magazine, what is your biggest fear about terrorism? You tell us at WVLKAM.com. Tune in for the results with Cruiser and Crew between noon and 3. This is a Forensic Friday. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us this morning. Good morning, Ray.
Morning, Jack.
Ray, you gave us a little preview last hour, but for those who were not with us last hour, tell us about what we're going to talk about this morning and our guests who you brought with you.
Okay. One of the crimes that that people get in general get concerned about is what they call white collar crime. Why do the white collar criminals get away with it? And you get catch somebody with a pocket full of dope, and they end up getting in trouble. And why do these guys and gals that wear suits and ties and that sort of thing don't seem to ever get in trouble? Well, they do get in trouble. And we want to talk a little bit about a financial crime today that occurred right here in Lexington. And with us is Detective Mike Helmsby, who is a I hate to say this in front of him, but is a very impressive financial crimes detective. And, of course, I'll have to deny that to all of the other detectives.
Good morning, Mike. Morning.
Morning, sir.
And also with us is a prosecutor from our office that was involved in this case, and his name is Francisco Javier Villalobos, also known to us as Paco.
And because nobody can pronounce it, is that right?
It's a little bit simpler.
Yeah.
One syllable.
Good morning, Paco.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here, sir. How long have you been with the Commonwealth Attorney's Office?
Here in Fayette County, I've been here for about 8 months now. And before that, I was in Madison County for about 2 years, or a little over 2 years.
And the Commonwealth Attorney's, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Very good.
He's got an interesting background. Like, if I can take a minute,
sure,
and introduce him. So tell us a little bit about your background, Paco.
My heritage?
Sure.
At work. My father was originally born in Mexico, but grew up in Chicago. My mom is from Germany. So I'm both Mexican and German descent, though I speak neither Spanish nor German. So it's a very interesting,
that is interesting
fact about myself, despite the name.
Yeah.
He came to our attention as a result of one of our prosecutors, Megan Kinsolving. Mm-hmm. And Megan, tell us how you and Megan were acquainted.
Megan and I go really far back. We went to the Governor's Scholar Program back in 2003 when we were in high school. And then we went to law school together. And she is married now to one of my good friends out of high school. And they also live about four houses down the road from us now. We got married around the same time. We bought our house around the same time. So she and I are pretty much joined at the hip for a long time now.
Nice.
Well, that isn't exactly what I wanted him to talk about. I want him to talk about the fact that he and Megan were on a trial team representing the University of Kentucky. And when we hired Megan, we had an opening, and I was looking for somebody that could just kick rear ends and take names, and she said Paco would be the guy, and so we recruited him, and we're very pleased that he's with us.
Now, one thing I don't completely understand is that you say that you kind of assign cases based on a sort of a random thing, and yet you have people who specialize in certain areas in your office.
Well, here's what we do. We don't specialize. I mean, we don't say all of the sexual assault cases go here and all of the drug cases go here. What we do is ask our various prosecutors to pick an area that interests them And then we get them trained, and we send them to trainings and conferences and that sort of thing, so that they'll develop some sort of an expertise that can be drawn on by the other prosecutors. Now, Andrea Williams, Jack, who has been on the show a number of times, kind of manages our financial crimes cases for our office, and she will involve other prosecutors, or other prosecutors will get those cases and draw on Andrea's expertise. That's how we do it.
I see.
Yeah. Tell us how you got in, Mike, tell us how you got into the financial crimes business.
Well, I've been a police officer for 11 years in Lexington. When I got moved to the Detective Bureau approximately 4 years ago, I was assigned to the financial crimes unit. In school, I did study finance and enjoy it, and have loved it ever since.
You know, it's not sexy. It you know, it doesn't have the whatever you'd call the wow factor of some crime like we usually talk about here, but my suspicion is it probably happens more than we hear about.
Is that true?
There is a lot of financial crime and fraud going around, and they're good cases to work because you can follow the money. There's a money trail.
Yeah,
it's important to people. The money has to come in from somewhere, and then when it's stolen, it has to be spent or taken out and go somewhere else. So it's a challenge. It's almost like a puzzle to put it all back together and determine what happened over several years or a short period of time.
You know, Jack, to the general public, I guess, maybe it sounds it's not a big-time homicide or that sort of thing. But I find these cases fascinating for the very reason that Mike mentioned. And that is, if you sit back and methodically go through this process, you're always going to solve it. And now, the challenge for people like Paco and Andrea is to simplify the case so that a jury that comes in, knows nothing about it, can get the big picture. And that's one of the things that happened in this case. Now, this case involves a woman named Ann Adkins, who was a bookkeeper for a local orthodontics practice for over 15 years. And I got a call from one of the orthodontists who I go to church with, said, I think we've got a problem with our bookkeeper. And I said, well, so I referred that to Andrea. And then Andrea has a meeting between Detective Helmsby and the orthodontist. And that's so what happens when you have that kind of a meeting?
Well, we speak to the victims. They explain why they believe they're missing the money, what financial crime they believe has happened to them, and we go from there. We start by subpoenaing bank records or obtaining bank records and canceled checks, deposits from the victims, and we work it backwards to see what exactly has happened.
Is it important to not let the person who you suspect of doing the stealing know that they're under suspicion, or do you let them know right up front that they're a suspect?
It depends. A lot of the times, like in this case, she was the sole bookkeeper for the business. So when they began questioning her about the deposits and how they weren't accurate, she left and never came back. So at that point, she knew probably that she was being investigated.
But Jack, the secret to these kind of cases is the records are the records. And you can't go back and redo the records.
Right.
What was the scheme? What was she doing?
It actually was a very simple scheme. She was just stealing the cash payments. When someone would come into the office, they can pay by check, credit card, or cash. When someone paid with cash, she would simply steal it, put it in her pocket, purse, take it home. And then she would make the end-of-the-day deposit with the credit cards and the checks to the bank. And she would just doctor the books to appear as though the money matched with the deposit. So when you looked at it in their accounting software, all the ledgers, all the books were accurate. They were all correct. The balances were what they were supposed to be. However, the bank deposits didn't reflect any cash deposits. That shorted them over $200,000 of money that should have been deposited into their account.
$200,000 over how long a period?
Approximately 10 years.
10 years. All right, let's take a break. If you have a question or comment, we want to hear it. 253-59-R590 from AT&T. toll-free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. Email jackpatty at wvlkam.com. We're talking about what I guess you'd call white-collar crime, and that is a woman by the name of Ann Adkins worked as a bookkeeper for an orthodontics firm for over 15 years and was caught after an investigation having stolen, it sounds like to me, up around $200,000 over the course of a number of years. This is Mary. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I was just simply listening to your radio. This is the only channel I'll listen to early in the morning.
We appreciate that.
Well, it just occurred to me, why in the world did it take, 10 years or so to realize that they think they have a problem? That seems kind of unusual to me. And then the second thing, banks usually have personalities, at least I know they do for people. And I would think that the bank would, I know this has been a long time, but I would think that the bank would become aware that there was no cash deposits coming in and kind of think that's unusual, you know?
I think that's, so, I think those are two very good questions, Mary. I'll let you listen to the answers off the air. Why did it take 10 years for the company to get suspicious?
Well, she was the lone bookkeeper for the company during that period of time. And the business is fairly successful. It does have a lot of money coming in, going out, and expenses, things of that nature. So
what she was taking was small in proportion to the total amount of money.
Correct. They didn't notice it missing.
What about the bank? That's a good question. The bank wouldn't catch that you guys never have any cash deposits?
Well, it may be unusual for some businesses to take cash. Some doctor's office businesses do only take check and credit card.
I see.
As long as deposits were coming in and the customer doesn't, the account holder doesn't come forward and ask or inquire as to why the balances aren't correct.
Yeah.
And with her doctoring the books, they believe that their bank balances were correct and never approached the bank with any issues.
Well, the bank is not in the... I can't imagine that the bank's in the business of saying a certain percentage of everybody's deposits ought to be cash or check or credit card kind of thing.
Right.
That kind of thing is not on the bank. However, you know, there are a lot of situations, Mike, where the banks have reported suspicious activities that they see about people coming in and cashing checks on accounts that are guardians or executors or that sort of thing, and have alerted the police and our office about those things. It turned into investigations. So the banks do a pretty good job of knowing their customers, and when something does look suspicious, they're pretty proactive.
And what about the Internal Revenue Service? When do they get suspicious if something unusual happens? If you're a business that does largely checks and suddenly you start making large amounts of cash deposit, does that red flag the bank that may report that to the IRS? Or how does that work?
Are you aware of these? What are the things where you've got $10,000 deposit has to be or over has to be reported to the IRS and that sort of thing?
Is that right?
And we get one of the things that has been a concern is laundering money. Mm-hmm. Money laundering.
Mm-hmm.
And when people make cash deposits of over $10,000 or withdrawals of over $10,000, those have to be reported.
I see.
I don't know that I don't know what the IRS does anymore. Do you? Everybody's afraid to answer.
Yeah, right.
That
no,
one.
We're
my taxes.
We saw nothing. We heard nothing. We saw nothing.
Yeah. Well, I'll be audited this time tomorrow.
Right.
So that's.
We think they do a great job. All right. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, you said this was a sole bookkeeper for this orthodontics
yes,
firm. So. What's the after this whole thing has transpired, what do you recommend to businesses about that kind of a situation? Because there are probably more businesses that have a sole bookkeeper than don't. So what's the recommendation to this orthodontics crowd about how should they be, what should they be doing to avoid this sort of thing in the future.
Well, it's always good to have someone coming behind and checking the bookkeeper, or having a couple different bookkeepers who check each other's work, and also have a CPA. This company actually had a CPA firm who went in and examined the books and found the discrepancies for them.
It was sort of after the fact, though, after they'd already...
Correct.
Yeah.
They took the books to the CPA and asked, you know, what was wrong, what was the cash, and they were able to discover what had happened and noticed how she was changing the deposits and changing the books.
This is Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hi, guys. I know those orthodontists, Darty and Tipton, they're super guys. I took my daughter to them. Now, Mr. Larson, was that at all their practices around, or was it just for the Lexington place?
Do you know?
Well, Mike, do you have any idea?
The theft that we investigated was taking place in the Lexington office, but we did know that some funds that were paid to the, I believe it was the Paris office, were also stolen once it made its way to the Lexington office.
So is she doing the books for more than one office? Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your call.
Okay.
Got about a minute before the break. Why don't we go ahead and take it, and then we'll come back. 253-59. We're back. We're talking about the case involving a local woman. This was a Lexington case. Defendant's name, Ann Adkins, who over a course of about 15 years was slowly taking money from Bluegrass Orthodontics, was finally caught. And we were talking off the air, Ray, about what was she, spending the money on, drugs, or do you know what she was spending the money on? Any idea?
Mike, tell us what you found out.
Well, we examined her bank records, and a lot of these cases either have a gambling problem, a narcotics problem, or just a spending problem.
Or a girlfriend problem.
Yeah.
Ms. Adkins appeared to just supplement her income, buying things that she wouldn't usually be able to afford on her normal salary, just like to shop.
So it wasn't drugs or any kind of gambling issues or anything like that?
No signs of drug use, no signs of any gambling. Hmm. Just like to shop.
High-end purses. That'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so all of a sudden you've done the investigation. How do you, Mike, how do you and the prosecutor in the case determine how this is going to be charged?
Well, we take all the evidence at hand, all the subpoenaed information that we were able to obtain. We spreadsheet it out, put it into a readable document, and then I usually meet with Andrea Williams, the prosecutor, and we go over the information and decide which way the case is best handled as far as what charges we're going to place.
Well, what happened in this case?
This case, Andrea and I decided that the best way to charge this case was per year. So we added up the total money, the total amount of theft per year, and then charged her with a theft by deception over $10,000 for every year that she took over $10,000 from the business.
Okay, so that is presented to the grand jury. And you testified in front of the grand jury.
Yes, sir, I did.
Now, this is Crime Fighters 101, the grand jury is made up of citizens that are drawn randomly from the jury panel each month, and they listen to witnesses like Mike testify about a case, and then you leave the room, and in this case, Andrea probably left the room, and the grand jury deliberates by themselves about what they think an appropriate charge would be, and she was charged with a number of counts of theft over $10,000. Isn't that correct, Paco?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's what happens. Now, she is then arraigned in circuit court, and then there's such a thing as a pretrial conference. What is that all about?
Typically, after a defendant gets arraigned on the charges, we set up a meeting with them and their attorney at the courthouse. We sit down. Typically, those can go for a while. They can be relatively short depending on the cooperation that we get from either the defense attorney or the defendant. And we talk a little bit about the case, about the evidence and proof that we have, what we believe is appropriate punishment in that case, where we will, I guess, make an offer in the case if they wish to plead guilty based on the evidence that we have. This is the amount of years that we're going to recommend that they need to serve or plead guilty to. And then from there, they'll leave and come back to court. And some point down the road, they will make a decision to either plead guilty to that recommendation or ask for a trial date and go to trial instead.
But now, did this Ann Adkins end up pleading guilty?
She did. I think, as Detective Helsby was talking about off the air a little while ago, a lot of these financial crimes will not go to trial simply because of the paper trail. The writing is literally written on the wall. You have the paperwork in front of you. It's hard to get around the numbers. And in this particular case, with the amount of records from the bookkeeper, from the orthodontist, from the banks, I think the writing was on the wall, and here she ended up pleading guilty.
Okay.
Hang on. Here's a call. Eugene, good morning.
Yeah. My question is, people get jail time, and they have restitution to pay. We're talking about $100,000 in restitution. Are these people ever actually pay this restitution? Is this money actually ever paid?
That's a great question that we were going to get to, restitution. And that, is that in your deal that you made, was that part of the deal?
We always, when there are financial crimes or any theft-related crimes, we always ask for restitution to be paid, which is going to be ordered by the court. Whether that gets paid is going to be a condition of the defendant's probation, if they're placed on probation, parole, should they ever get paroled, and they will be required to pay that back. In this particular case, we asked for the restitution to be paid, and I believe a large amount of that restitution was, in fact, paid, I think, prior to or as part of her sentencing.
Did she own property or something that could be sold for that restitution?
I believe the agreement in this case was that she signed over, I believe it was her retirement account, over to the business itself.
I see.
And that was a substantial amount of money. Now she's in prison.
That's correct.
Who was the judge in this case?
I believe it was Judge Ishmael.
Yeah. And, that's good. And
what was the sentence?
I believe it was 14 years altogether with all the charges that were brought.
And what will she supposedly serve before she's eligible?
Well, she's eligible under Kentucky law, or WIMPE sentencing law. She's eligible after serving 20%. I don't know if that's 20% of the 14 years or 20% of the various sentences that accumulate to 14 years. The only people that really know how long they're going to serve are the criminals. And they can tell you to the second when they're going to get out.
And then every now and then you hear about somebody getting something called shock probation.
Okay.
What is that?
Typically when an individual comes up for their sentencing, after they've already pled guilty, the judge will make a determination whether or not they should be probated or not. If the judge says no probation, well, then they go to prison. But then about at least 30 days, they can apply for shock probation, essentially asking the judge, well, reconsider. Let me back out on probation. Let me on probation.
Well, let me be a little more realistic about it. The theory behind shock probation is that somebody is sent to prison and they are so shocked by the situation that they found themselves in that they have seen the light and will follow the do right doctrine for the rest of their lives because of the shock of being incarcerated. Yeah. So what happens then is that's the theory. And did she apply, did this woman apply for shock probation?
She did. She was both denied probation and denied shock probation.
So is she still in custody?
She is still in custody.
So now, as far as restitution goes, there are some, Eugene asked a great question. Because there are some, this is unusual. Because when you get somebody that steals $200,000, the chances of that being repaid are almost, it just almost doesn't happen. Jack, you're getting restitution checks for your two burglaries. Tell us about that.
Well, I haven't gotten one for a while.
Oh.
They kind of dry it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fancy that.
Yeah.
But you'd get a check for something like $12.50.
Or $21.84.
Sort of thing. And but the bottom line is that these people steal, and then the court requires them to pay restitution as a condition of their probation. And then when we bring them back and say they're not paying restitution, they say, well, okay, I'm going to give you another chance. So this is their 13th second chance.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they just basically get their freedom. They get the money. And the victim is kind of out of luck. And that's a real complaint that we receive.
But it doesn't sound like it was so much in this case.
This one's still in custody. This case was better.
Yeah.
And we like that.
Taking a break, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wblkam.com. Our time is 9:43, 17 before 10. White collar crime, that's our subject this morning, 13 minutes before the hour of 10 o'clock, and we've got a caller holding. Let's go to Douglas. Good morning, Douglas. Douglas, are you there? Yeah, let me see here. Hello? Hello? Okay, we lost Douglas, Ray.
Okay, Mike, we've talked a little bit about the single bookkeeper issue that this organization had. And you have told us on the air here that they should have had somebody follow up and or come behind or have an audit regularly. Do you all in the financial crimes unit of the Lexington Police Department, do you all do kind of prevention programs for businesses around town?
We do presentations to various groups if they request us. We speak to the CPA, the Citizens Police Academy. We go to retirement homes. We've gone to churches, neighborhood meetings, things of that nature. We actually have several presentations prepared that we can go give to the members. Regular businesses, if they can call the police department number and ask to speak to someone with the financial crimes unit, we can usually answer your question over the phone. And if it's determined more contact is needed, we'll come to your business and see if we can assist.
And you mentioned senior citizen centers. I'm sure they are victims a lot of times, aren't they, in these things?
Usually of scams.
Yeah.
Well, it's Chris Russell. It's crimes against the elderly is something Chris Russell, who's been on the show a number of times as a superstar detective,
mm-hmm.
It talks a little bit about that, and that families frequently have family members that are basically stealing from parents or grandparents and that sort of thing. And grandparents and parents, Jack, are reluctant to prosecute those cases because they're embarrassed.
Right.
That somebody in their family would do that to them, and they're embarrassed that they didn't know about it, and that sort of thing. And so, so as a result, a lot of people get away with that sort of thing. And it's just people need to be responsible for their behavior. And the one way to do it is report it to the police if you find out. Do you get a lot of that sort of thing? What are the most common kind of schemes that you deal with in the financial crimes operation over there?
Well, it is the family members stealing from parents and grandparents. And the problem with those cases is even if we prove it is the suspect, a lot of the times the family member decides that they don't wish to prosecute, and those cases go uncharged. And then we do have the phone scams, the lottery scams, the home improvement scams, you name it, the various other scams that target the elderly, where they're requesting cash or green dot cards. We have a variety.
What's a green dot card?
A green dot card is a prepaid money card, which you buy and set up. It's like a prepaid credit card. And then you fund those with what's called a money pack, which you purchase at a department store and load with as much money as you choose, up to $500. Well, a lot of these people are talking the victims into going out and purchasing a money pack, scratching the number off the back, and then giving them the 16-digit code number off the back, which then drains the money pack card, and the suspects place the money on their own card and go spend it. We see that a lot.
That's horrible. This is Ken. Good morning, Ken.
Yeah, hey, I got a question for Mr. Larson.
Yes.
What about this fellow that stole between, I don't know, $13 and $17 million was the rumor from the Pepsi-Cola plant several years ago?
Well,
remember that case?
No, I don't.
The FBI confronted him. It's been on the Crime Stoppers television several times. Mm-hmm. His first name was Jim. I can't remember his last name.
So is it an FBI case?
I guess it turned into that. Yeah. He stole several million dollars over a period of several years.
Hmm.
And his house burned up with his wife in it. And there was all kinds of rumors about, you know, him and his confrontations with the fire department and so forth.
Well,
it happened right here in Lexington.
Well, I'm familiar with the house burning and the wife dying, but I'm not familiar with the financial allegation.
The rumor was between $13 and $17 million, and when the FBI took him up to the home office in Cincinnati, rather than keeping him there and putting him in handcuffs, they let him go.
Yeah.
So on his way back to Lexington, he threw his cell phone into a dumpster, which they finally found that. And then he had two tickets to someplace, you know, out of the country, Bermuda or whatever. He was an expert scuba driver. And so I'm sure he's down in the Caribbean someplace with that money.
Well, we ought to have the FBI on, because we don't deal with FBI cases most of the time. The U.S. attorney is supposed to do that.
You know, so we had them on. We had some federal investigators, federal prosecutors on one time. And that was the most, that was the longest hour I think I ever spent in my life. Those guys are not all that exciting. You think they would be. See, I can say that. You can't.
Sure, I can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You agree they weren't all that exciting?
Well, that okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
We won't say what case it was, because then they'll know who we're talking about.
All right.
Yeah.
You got it. At any rate, if the FBI is investigating the case, they will take that to the U.S. Attorney's office. And, or that they'll take it to the U.S. Attorney's office for prosecution. Mm-hmm. We don't get involved in that. But I do remember the fire that was on Turkey Foot over
was
there.
It?
Mm-hmm. And the wife was died in the fire. Now, I don't know, that never came to our office as a arson case or anything else.
I wonder how many of these cases, and I don't mean specifically numbers, but cases like the one we talked about today, where a single bookkeeper in a relatively small business takes money over the course of a number of years. Do you get a dozen of those a year? Do you get one every so often? How common is it, I guess, is my question.
It's fairly common. We do get several a year.
Are the people that are ripped off, in essence, the business owners, ever reluctant to pursue this person for the same reasons that the family in these cases isn't? Because they, you know, obviously they have a relationship with this person, that and their trust has obviously been altered. But are they sometimes not willing to prosecute?
I don't see that nearly as much as with family members.
Okay.
It usually depends on the dollar amount as well. If it's a small amount or an amount that they believe the employee can pay back fairly quickly, sometimes they may just terminate them and not move forward with pleasant.
And then sometimes it's probably merchandise, too, rather than money, merchandise that has been taken, right?
It is. You know, merchandise, property. It's not always bookkeepers. It's just possibly employees removing money from the business, whether it be a safe deposit box or a...
Whatever. Thank you guys very much for being with us. Thank you, Ray.
See you next time.
See you next week. Thank you, Paco.
Thank you, sir.
And stand by. We have an update from the information.